Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, July 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the White House denies that Trump again contradicted intel agencies on Russia.
The president and his administration are working very hard to make sure that Russia is unable to meddle in our elections.
The U.S. Fed chair briefs lawmakers on how trade and tariffs will impact the economy. 1 week after their dramatic rescue from a flooded cave, 12 Thai teens tell reporters about the ordeal. And one of the largest and most complete T-Rex skeletons ever discovered about to go on display. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, there was confusion at the White House on Wednesday about whether President Trump again contradicted conclusions of the U.S. intelligence agency or community during a cabinet meeting on Wednesday. The president shook his head and said, thank you very much, no, when asked if Russia still poses a threat to the United States. Hours later in the briefing room, press secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders explained that Trump was actually saying no to answering questions and not to the reporter's question itself.
I talked to the president. He wasn't answering that question. He was saying no, he's not taking questions.
Mr. Trump Wednesday insisted no president has been as tough as he has been on Russia and affirmed he accepted the view Russia meddled in the 2016 election. Joining us now to get the perspective of a former U.S. diplomat is former ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Well, amid the controversy surrounding his recent trip to Europe, including a NATO summit and his private meeting with Russia's leader, what is your view on all that's been happening?
So for those of us who are working on long-term relations with Russia, long-term relations with Europe, we're concerned about getting past the noise and figuring out what the substance is. Well, first, let's talk about the noise. The noise is that it shouldn't be a surprise to us that given the overall approach that Trump has taken to international affairs, a kind of a nation-state-based competition, that he's not playing by the etiquette rules that 70 years of tradition have left in the United States. Those of us like myself who are traditional diplomats are sometimes stunned that he won't, but we really shouldn't be surprised. He's been saying this for a while. Secondly, then you say, well, what is the effect of all this? Well, institutions like NATO, institutions like transatlantic relationships, institutions like the U.S. Congress or the business community's response to Russia, those things are pretty strong. And even though we can talk about, and some people are writing about, the decay of relationships, are the NATO allies angry with us and going to act differently? Are we giving away too much to the Russians? The institutions are still there. There's still a 98 vote in the Senate to remain, keep sanctions on. The American military working closely with NATO still has troops that are in Europe and are committed to Europe's security. So I don't think that what we've seen is an entire world that's been thrown into reverse or knocked off course. I think rather we've seen an enormous stylistic change. And the real trick is going to be trying to figure out what is going to remain from this. What are the substantive changes that are going to remain? What's interesting about what happened in Russia is the president talked for a couple of hours with President Putin. And we don't know what they talked about. So my initial take on what happened in NATO and what happened in Helsinki is that we got a lot of noise and a lot of flash and a lot of smoke, and it's going to take a little while for us to sort out what that really means. What happens next? Anyone's guess.
What about some of the attacks on our allies and the praise of Putin in that news conference while criticizing the U.S. and sort of blaming the U.S. for some of the things that our intelligence agencies said Russia did? Does that damage the credibility of our ability to hold sacred our intelligence, say, with other countries that may normally want to share intelligence with us?
Very good question. I still think that the structures are in place. I don't want to be too Pollyannish about this because I think he's done real damage. Everyone agrees that this style is a damaging style, and building trust is an enormous part of diplomacy, and he's broken down, or at least seems to want to break down, the trust that we've had with the leadership of Britain, France, Germany especially, and to put into question some of the strength of the positions we put in to resist what has been Russian bad behavior. I would be surprised if the allies said, we're not going to share intelligence with you anymore. Probably what the Europeans have to do is swallow their unhappiness and continue to work with the Americans, because you learn so much more from the Americans than you give to the Americans. The damage in the long run with relationships, though, is more of a conceptual problem that I think is going to take years and years to solve, which is, does the structure that we've created, whereby we have trust with like-minded governments and we have a vision of the way we should live by so-called rules-based diplomacy, is that under fire? We don't know the damage this kind of behavior will have. But I would just caution against the more apocalyptic reports that people make, that everything has collapsed. I think it's really concerning to people who want to see diplomatic solutions based on trust, based on common values, based on other things. It's not that the Europeans are going to stop working with the Americans, and at a working level, it's the Americans aren't going to stop working with the Europeans.
During the news conference with President Trump and President Putin, Mr. Putin had suggested that maybe Russian investigators question a U.S.-born investor and a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. And then when asked about it at Wednesday's briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters that the president will consider allowing Russian investigators to question these people. The State Department spokeswoman pushed back on that and said it was outrageous. So where do you, as a former ambassador, stand on that?
I would be very surprised. On the one hand, you can talk, if you're the president, about saying what he really wants to do is have better relationships with the Russians. Then when you really get down to the substance of saying, we are going to treat a country that our intelligence services have said has attacked the United States in a way as if that hadn't happened, or, you know, to gloss over things, then that kind of the mechanisms there, I think, get very difficult. So my take is, I don't think it's likely that that will happen. A lot of people are very angry. And so I would just be very surprised if that initiative went into war.
That's former U.S. ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A Secret Service agent has died on an overseas trip. Turkey protests the U.S. effort to block the sale of F-35 fighters. The EU regulator hits Google with a record $5 billion fine. And a ninth rhino has died at a new Kenyan sanctuary. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the chairman of the U.S. Central Bank, Jerome Powell, told lawmakers the U.S. is on track for years of steady growth and even indicated the Trump administration's trade policies could have a positive outcome as long as they're not long-lasting. Powell testified before the House Financial Services Committee on Wednesday, where he also said tariffs like the ones the administration has levied on steel and aluminum imports and on Chinese goods are the wrong approach and could be felt if they remain in place for too long.
If this process leads to a world of higher tariffs on a wide range of goods and services that are traded, and those are sustained for a longer period of time, in other words, if it results in a more protectionist world, that'll be bad for our economy. And it'll be bad for other economies, too. It'll be bad for the world economy. That is not what the administration says they're trying to achieve. And again, it isn't up to us to criticize their policies in this activity. But, you know, the evidence is clear that countries that remain open to trade have higher productivity. They have higher incomes. Not every group is affected positively by trade. There are groups that are hurt by trade, and I think all countries have learned that they need to do a better job of addressing the needs of those populations, but not through trade barriers and tariffs of that kind of thing.
Gary Huffbauer is a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the latest signs of economic activity in June show great numbers in industrial and manufacturing production, as well as mining output.
I mean, the economy is doing extremely well. The U.S. is doing much better than other advanced countries, in fact, better than most countries. The concern is that, you know, maybe a slowdown elsewhere will slow the U.S. economy. There are two indicators which suggest that that's not impossible. One is the price of copper, which has been a very good weather vane over the decades, really. It's been down quite a bit. And the other is the long-term bond yield, the 30-year bond yield, which, while short-term interest rates are rising, the long-term rate has not been rising. In fact, it's even fallen a little bit lately, which suggests that people are cautious. Investors are cautious about the state of the economy, you know, going forward the next couple of years. So those are flags on the horizon. There are always some flags, but those are the ones today, which I'm sure the Fed is paying attention to.
Unemployment at 4%, considered maximum employment. Why all the good news? What is the cause of it?
Well, the main cause of the good news is the tax bill, which was passed last year, or, you know, went into effect early this year in 2018. A big reduction in tax rates for business. Secondly, it's a big fiscal stimulus to the overall economy, a huge fiscal stimulus. So the economy is getting the jolt from increased deficit spending. And I think those are the two reasons that we're seeing these really great numbers.
There was a lot of concern expressed in the Senate Banking Committee Tuesday about tariffs and trade tensions. Mr. Powell himself suggested that ultimately he hopes for a world of lower tariffs. He said, obviously, that tariffs is absolutely the wrong approach. Said the U.S. would feel it at the national level if levies remain in place.
He's absolutely correct. And Congress, or many congressmen and senators, are quite concerned that the tariff agenda of President Trump will undo the wonderful things that are happening because of his tax package, which was enacted. And that's a real concern on the Hill. You know, the trade agenda could really hurt the U.S. economy going into the second half of this year and into 2019.
The president of the European Commission is due in Washington next week for talks with President Trump. Huffbauer suggests a possible cut in the European Union's 10% tariff on auto imports may be on the agenda. 1 week after their dramatic rescue from a flooded cave complex, the 12 teenage members of a Thai football team met with reporters to describe their ordeal. The Wild Boars team members were discharged Wednesday morning from a hospital in Chiang Rai and then met with reporters. And journalist Steve Sanford is in Chiang Rai telling, and he tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the news conference.
They were brought before quite a packed house of media, international as well as the local media. And there were friends and family, officials that were also there. Yeah, so it was quite a joyful moment. Kids looked like they were in good spirits. They were laughing and joking. They were kicking the soccer balls around that they had been given by the officials when they came into the town hall. And they looked in pretty good health, certainly a lot better than 9 days into the cave drama when the British rescuers found them. They were quite thin.
Do medical officials feel that they will be okay or they will have any long-term effects from their ordeal?
It's an interesting question. They basically had been feeding them a lot of healthy foods and bringing them back up to try to get to the level they were before they went in the cave. At the same time, there were concerns about their mental health, which was refreshing to see, I guess, especially in a part of the world such as we are in. They had brought a psychiatrist along to look at the questions, actually, that the media were told to submit yesterday. So basically, the media submitted the questions a day ahead of this press conference, and then the questions were looked over for their sensitivity for the children. And the psychiatrist was also looking at the questions, and I guess they picked from that.
Did the boys talk about their ordeal? I mean, how they kept their spirits up? Were they able to eat any food while they were in the cave, at least before the rescuers found them?
I mean, they had brought some snacks into the cave when they originally went. It was planned the Wednesday before the Saturday practice, according to the coach, and he posted it on Facebook that they were going to go in for a little bit of exploring in the Saturday afternoon following their practice. But they got to a certain point where the water levels were rising, and the coach had turned to go back. And basically, they realized that they were sort of locked in now from the water. Yeah, so it was basically a plan to just to go in there after the practice, but it turned out to be a lot longer.
Now, I believe one of the boys speaks English, and he was able to communicate with the British divers that first found them.
That's right. He's quite an accomplished student at the local school in May Sai, and he spoke a few different languages. I believe he was one of the team members that was originally from Burma. Yeah, he had a high grade average at his school, and he could speak English. So it was quite refreshing when the diver spoke to the group in English, and then he responded.
Did the boys speak at all about the former Thai Navy SEAL, Saman Gunan, who died during the rescue operation?
Right. Actually, they did. In fact, following this ordeal and the press conference, they're planning to be ordained as novice monks for 9 days, I believe, starting on July 26th. And part of this process is to honor the fallen Navy Thai SEAL diver who gave his life while trying to deliver oxygen to the group. So they are quite aware of this situation, and they're going to be commemorating his life with his ordination at this monastery.
And did the coach speak during the news conference?
Yes, the coach spoke quite a bit during the press conference. He was also speaking about some of the regrets. I mean, all of the kids were asked, you know, what did you learn from this experience? And of course, most of them were replying that, you know, they would give more thought before doing something. And in the coach's case, he said that he basically, you know, it was a big experience for him, but he would think in the future more before doing something like this.
That's reporter Steve Sanford in Chiang Rai, Thailand. Well, flights have resumed between Ethiopia and Eritrea for the first time in 2 decades, sealing a stunning reconciliation between the once warring nations. Reuters' Anna Bevan reports.
Celebrations on board this Ethiopian Airlines plane as it made history on Wednesday by becoming the first commercial flight from Ethiopia to Eritrea in 20 years. The flight cements peace efforts between the once warring nations a week after they ended their military standoff. Families separated from loved ones since the start of a brutal border war sat next to dignitaries as they prepared to land in the Eritrean capital of Asmara.
Since Ethiopia and Eritrea create peace, we have come here. I have come here to look for my grand family, and I have a business in Addis, so I'm planning to open sister company in Asmara as well.
All right, and that was Reuters' Anna Bevan reporting. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. South Africans engaged in charity events Wednesday to mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela, the nation's first black president, and on the centennial, Barack Obama, the first black U.S. president, met in Johannesburg with young leaders from across Africa. A day earlier, he delivered what might have been the strongest of statements of his post-presidential life. VOA's Anita Powell has more.
It was the rhetorical punch that Barack Obama supporters had been waiting for him to deliver since he left office 18 months ago. In a wide-ranging speech commemorating Nelson Mandela's birth, Obama sketched a rosy picture of the progress and equality brought about by progressive leaders like the late Mandela, and then contrasted that with what Obama called today's strange and uncertain politics.
Strongman politics are ascendant, suddenly, whereby elections and some pretense of democracy are maintained, the form of it, but those in power seek to undermine every institution or norm that gives democracy meaning. In the West, you've got far-right parties that oftentimes are based not just on platforms of protectionism and closed borders, but also on barely hidden racial nationalism.
John Stremlaw is a professor of international relations at the University of the Witwatersrand. He says Obama described an attractive alternative to the proliferation of right-wing politics.
I thought it was offering all of us a progressive alternative to the strongman autocratic tendencies that are showing themselves in too many countries of the world, including the United States. And for Barack Obama to embrace Mandela a day after Trump embraced Putin in Helsinki drew a very stark contrast, even though it was implicit.
Strömlö was referring to the summit this week in Finland's capital between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. While Trump's name did not come up in Obama's 90-minute speech, the former president delivered a number of backhands, clearly aimed at his immediate predecessor, like this one.
Unfortunately, too much of politics today seems to reject the very concept of objective truth. People just make stuff up. They just make stuff up. We see the utter loss of shame among political leaders where they're caught in a lie and they just double down and they lie some more.
And this one.
Don't you get a sense sometimes, I'm ad-libbing here, that these people who are so intent on putting people down and puffing themselves up that they're small-hearted. That there's something they're just afraid of.
Politically, Strömlö says Obama tried to strengthen two very different movements. That of new South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who took over after scandal-ridden President Jacob Zuma resigned in February, and of Obama's Democratic Party, which is trying to win back a congressional majority in midterm elections later this year.
I think its real significance is that what Obama was doing was outlining a strategy for the Democrats for the 18 congressional elections coming up. He's been relatively quiet, as you know, since he left the White House. This was his first major public address. And I like the idea that he gave such a substantive rationale for an approach to politics that is progressive but also intelligent and faithful to Mandela. But he could also just, you know, circulate that speech to all in the Democratic Party.
For all of his warnings, Obama urged those listening to hold on to hope and strenuously defend democracy. And, as if in reply, the crowd of 15,000 people who gathered in the cricket stadium in the bitter cold responded with a chant. Yes, they said, we can. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, the fossilized skeleton of a ferocious Tyrannosaurus rex dinosaur will be on exhibit next year in the new Fossil Hall at the Museum of Natural History in Washington. Excavated in Montana, it's one of the largest and most complete T-Rex skeletons ever discovered. The dinosaur, called the nation's T-Rex, will become part of a larger showcase that explores billions of years of life on Earth. VOA's Deborah Block takes us on a sneak peek.
Pieces of the giant T-Rex arrived in large crates. Inside one of them, two giant thigh bones, another containing the animal's huge skull, complete with razor-sharp teeth. But dinosaur curator like Matthew Carano tells us this dinosaur head is a replica because the original bones are too fragile for display.
An adult Tyrannosaurus, such as this specimen here, they tend to be 40 to 45 feet long. They stand about 16 feet tall, and they can weigh anywhere from 5 to 10 tons. It does have these fantastic 6-inch teeth that we know were capable of punching through solid bone.
The nation's T-Rex is not only important because it contains many of the original bones, but because it also gave scientists new clues about the meat-eating dinosaur.
It was the first specimen where the arm had been known. So we always knew T-Rex had a very small arm, but we'd never really seen it all.
Paleontologists have learned a lot about dinosaurs in recent years, including their age. This one was just a teenager when it died.
By the time they were about 20, they were pretty much full-sized. And after that, although they, you know, got a little bit longer and a little bit taller, mostly they just got bigger. So they would sort of bulk up. Again, not all that different from the way we grow as humans.
Unlike the museum's dark fossil hall of the past, this new one will show off more scientifically accurate depictions of how dinosaurs lived. Kirk Johnson, head of the museum, says more than 700 specimens will be on display.
But in addition to the skeletons and the fossils, we'll have beautiful art, we'll have incredible interpretation panels, we'll have digital interactives, we'll have all the things that make all those real things accessible to audiences of all ages.
Johnson hopes the millions of visitors who will come to visit the new exhibit, when it opens in June next year, will find it both informative and exciting.
And if they're young, I hope that they understand that they can become agents for the future, that they can understand things themselves, they can become scientists, they can become positive forces for good in the planet, and think about the future.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Local crime prevention in the Kyrgyz Republic got a boost this month from the United States. On July 10th, First Deputy Minister of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, Suwan Omurzakov, and the Director of the Office of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement at the U.S. Embassy in Bishkek, Sandeep Paul, inaugurated the Local Crime Prevention Center, or LCPC, in Amir Timur, a neighborhood in Osh City, with a population of 52,000 facing issues of unemployment, domestic violence, drug addiction, forced early marriage, and youth involvement in radical and violent groups. The Amir Timur LCPC represents a true partnership with 64%, approximately $15,000 of the funding provided by the U.S. Embassy's Office of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, 18%, approximately $4,500 by the Osh City Mayor's Office, 11%, approximately $2,600 by the Osh City Directorate on Employment, Migration, and Youth, and the remaining 7%, almost $2,000, by the local community. In his opening remarks, First Deputy Minister Omurzakov noted that this center is perfectly prepared to coordinate between the offices of the district militiaman, the chairman of the Aksakal Court, the Department for Work with Youth and Women's Councils, which will improve services provided to our citizens. INL Director Paul said community policing principles, respect for human rights, accountability, transparency, and rule of law, not only address but also help to prevent crimes in the areas of domestic violence and violence among youth, facilitate public discussion of safety and quality of life issues, and address the drivers of radicalization and violent extremism. Since 2013, the United States has directed approximately $4 million to support community policing and law enforcement reform at the national and grassroots level in the Kyrgyz Republic, supporting 24 communities and 23 local crime prevention centers, mainly in the south of the Kyrgyz Republic. The United States, said INL Director Paul, has partnered with Kyrgyz officials, international organizations, and civil society to promote community policing best practices because communities are strongest when they are working together and law enforcement works best when it has a close relationship with the community.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.